Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, excluding the greatest journalists, people like Robert Fisk, Ken Sengupta and Roger Cook. Remember him? Don't hear them on the BBC. Well, today we've got another journalist that used to get published in the Daily Mail. One of the greatest thinkers in the country, really. Very articulate guy, Neil Clark. Only thing is, his only place he can get published now is in Russia, unbelievably. But anyway, he has some very interesting things to say about the internet, particularly smears against him being circulated on the internet and trolls. Also, the whole thing of surveillance. I mean, how is it affecting journalists like him to be being constantly monitored? Also, we have Abs Ali. He's a young Somali man, and he talks about his home country, where he originally came from when he was tiny, and experience also of hostel life here in Bristol, living next door to robbers, maybe, even addicts. And also, he has his ideas about how to fix the housing crisis here in Bristol. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have got someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show. So we start with the British journalist Neil Clark, who can't get published in the British newspapers and never gets interviewed on any of the British TV, but he's one of the best journalists we've got. One of his articles, for example, having a look at the Jeremy Corbyn failure at the December 2019 general election, you can find online. It's entitled Destroyed by Appeasing His Enemies, The Shakespearean Tragedy of Jeremy Corbyn. That was published on the 14th of December 2019. And Neil here now talks about internet smears against him, the trolls you find on the internet, and also the ever-present problem of surveillance for journalists.
I've been targeted right since the end of 2005, after I wrote a critical book review of a pro-Iraq war book. And the person who wrote the book started to attack me on his blog. Thought nothing of it. You ignore it. Then something really creepy happened, was that the newspaper which I was writing for in Australia got an email from a guy called George Courtney, saying, you ought to see what this man has written about Neil Clark, your contributor, and sent in links to what the other person had written, the posts about me on his blog. And we did a bit of detective work. There's no such person as George Courtney. This person only existed to actually write booster comments about the writer on websites where he was discussed, and IP addresses, which I don't want to go into, but we got those, and he wasn't a real person. In fact, it was an alias made to get me the sack. And this happened for a long, long time. And as I said earlier, my Wikipedia page was targeted by an editor who I traced, and his work was interesting because he seemed to make a speciality of putting up very unfavourable edits to other anti-war journalists. Media Lens site was, he sort of took ownership of that to put in very critical stuff. And as soon as critical articles were written, they'd be posted straight away. Any positive stuff was taken down. So this is the sort of controlling editor of these pages. And that's happened to a lot of other anti-war writers, and happened to my page, where only negative stuff was put up to make me look like a complete fanatic or whatever. And so this kind of alerted me to what the stuff that's going on. And I've had an obsessional pursuit of me by another journalist who's blogged about me and my wife. He's even blogged about my wife. He's blogged about me obsessively. He's attacked me regularly on Twitter. He kind of monitors me all the time and has written libelous comments about me. I've been to the police about this. Even by the man's own admission, they spoke to him. And there's trolls who have helped him, who have supported him. Whenever I used to write for The Guardian, for example, I used to get the trolls popping up straight away to say, have you seen what X has written about Neil Clark? He's exposed him, blah, 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 all designed to destroy my reputation. The police, I've been to them, I think, three times now. There's still stuff going on. And I think it shows you that this warfare is going on against those of us who challenge the, you know, the dominant narrative. And it's all meant to intimidate. It's meant to bully and to try to frighten us, really, I think, and to make it very, very unpleasant. And I'm sure there's probably other anti-war writers who have had a similar experience, because the internet is fantastic. But the other downside of it is that somebody who is obsessed can do a lot of damage to people online. I noticed, for example, that he would be writing with my name in the title of blog posts. You know, obviously, I show up on a Google search of me, it would show up quite prominently. The aim being, and he actually boasted he'd done more to destroy my career as a political commentator than anybody else. So it's been very unpleasant and incredibly obsessional. Friends of mine say, well, you should be flattered, because it obviously he thinks that you are a sort of danger, because if you didn't, he wouldn't bother with you. But I think that this whole area of trolling, we need to out the trolls, really, and the best way of doing it is to publicise what's going on, really. I think the more people that share their experiences and talk about it, the better.
I think there is a sort of a tacit attempt to get writers like you and I to think, well, let's ignore this and hopefully it will go away. But of course, that's actually what they want, because they want to have the psychological effect of it on you, and they don't want you to write about it. They certainly don't want you to be articulating it to the general public and to others who may have had similar experiences, you know, of mobile phones being hacked, that sort of thing.
No, absolutely. That's why I say that actually talking about it, this is the best policy. I think it's all incredibly creepy. It's psychological warfare. It's intimidatory. It depends. If you're an anti-war writer and you get trolled, then you don't get the publicity about it. If you were a pro-war writer who got trolled by an anti-war figure, then of course that would be front page news. I think there's real double standards here.
There's quite a lot of opportunities for hackers criminally to get in there and to stop journalists even doing their job, you know, talking to even people like cabinet ministers.
Yeah, well, it's in this strange position, aren't we? Because in one hand, we've got the new technology, which helps our job. Could we, you know, easier to interview people, easier to get our information out, because we can have our own blogs and tweet, etc. But on the other hand, it's much easier for them, if you like, the powers that be who are against us, or people who are against us, to actually destroy us or to try to hack into us. So actually, in one sense, you could argue that we were better off 30, 40 years ago, when we didn't have mobiles, when we could arrange meetings, we had notepads, and we weren't subject to this. We actually weren't so easy to monitor and weren't so easy to track down.
This is another thing, isn't it? You've just reminded me as well. If you're going to see a confidential source, yeah, I suppose you have to be careful nowadays. You don't take your mobile phone along.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think that in the one sense, we've got this great position that we have got the internet. We can get the word out easier. But the other word, we're all being what? We're all being monitored. And it would be very difficult to get a genuinely sort of democratic movement going that would challenge the status quo, because that would be easily tracked, easily hacked, easily smeared. And it's a kind of double-edged sword. We're actually in many ways worse off than we were, you know, 30 years ago.
The psychological warfare people actually boast about being able to create fissures in new organisations. So as the new democratic movement starts to grow at its early stages, they're right in there smashing it to pieces.
Yeah, and this has always been the problem. Any genuine democratic organisation is agent provocateurs coming in, people coming in from security forces to try to destroy that and get division between people. But I think that the best way to defeat this, as I said, is to talk about it, to be absolutely open and actually say everything that's going on, to actually put it down there on the record, because they want us to be silent about this. They want to try and intimidate us to be silent. There's intimidation techniques which take place, which I've been subjected to try to silence people. And the more we speak up about it, the stronger our position is.
It's interesting, isn't it, as well? I think over the last few years, we've seen revelations about really what one would think is very simple, benign environmental campaigners campaigning against policies which lead to climate change, this kind of thing, being not only infiltrated by the Metropolitan Police, but relationships being formed, yeah, children being had, this kind of thing. The surveillance state seems to almost have got obsessive.
Yeah, it's completely and utterly out of control, and much worse, I think, than it was. But I think that the positive is that the exposure of these cases will create scepticism among people. I think that it's not quite
it's
as effective.
It's done immense damage to trust in the police, this kind of thing, sure.
Yeah. Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt. And I think that people are not quite as willing to believe the official line now as they were, because we had a lot of, when you think, Tony, we've had the Hillsborough, the revelations about Hillsborough, the cover-ups there, we've had child abuse stories, you know, we've had all the various child abuse cover-ups. So people now are less likely to take the official line. And I think people are getting savvy. They know that when you've got a sanctioned target, Julian Assange, you know, let's get him, whoever it may be. I think a lot of people are seeing through that now. They're now not falling perhaps so much for the attacks on dissidents as they might have done in the past.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Abs, so Abs Ali, quite short actually. I've shortened my name because a lot of people find it quite hard to say my name in full. It's Abdi Rizak, in fact.
So Abs is short for?
Abdi Rizak.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're originally from Somalia. When you were 2 years old, you came to the UK. Can you just give us a little bit of background? Obviously, you were too young to really remember, but what was going on in Somalia that meant you had to come to Britain?
So there was a civil war. The northern region and the southern region were at war. A bit like the politics in the UK, whereby the power was in the south and the power was not in the north at all, and even the economic stability of the north wasn't there. So there was a civil war. And what ended up happening between 1987 and 1991, 100,000 of my fellow tribesmen were killed. So I came here as a child, 2 years old, on my nan's back. My nan walked with a little goat by her side. I was on my nan's back, and she walked to Ethiopia. She crossed the borders of Somalia to the borders of Ethiopia. Reunited as a family there in a refugee camp. Not entirely sure how it happened, but we, thank God, ended up in the UK. So we started off in Manchester. My mum came here. She had five children. I was the fifth child, and she's pregnant with her sixth. So in Manchester, 1989, that's when we arrived.
Now, Somaliland, I think, was even part of the British Empire, wasn't it, at some point?
It was,
because the Brits have been involved. Let's just put people in the picture. Yeah. Somalia is on the sort of east of Africa at the north end, just kind of near, actually it's just opposite Iran. And we all know that if you look at Iran, you can see the Americans, and maybe the British too, but certainly the Americans have been surrounding Iran ever since the revolution in the 70s.
Yeah.
There's little bits of American military kind of coming all the way around Iran, almost to surround it, in a similar way actually that's happened to Russia. Various, like Afghanistan, the Americans and the Brits have their bases there. So, I mean, I wonder what you make of the theory, and I would definitely subscribe to this as being potentially why it all happened and why Somalia was destabilised is because there was a bigger game going on.
There's a massive game going on. It's still going on till today. So the way I see it, it was communist ruled from 1960s when Siad Barre took over. He was the dictator that became the mass murderer in the end. So it was Western powers and the Eastern powers were all fighting for this strip of land. Why? Because it's the land that connects you to the Suez Canal. It's the Horn of Africa, yeah? The Horn of Africa, which is right next to the Middle East.
They used to call it the ditch.
The ditch.
The slang in the 1920s in this country. Yeah, right. The ditch. We're going out to the ditch, you know.
Why would they call it that? I don't understand.
Well, because it's this ditch in the ships can go along.
Yeah, through the Swiss Canal. Okay, cool. I get that. Okay, I get that. Okay, so yeah, it's always been a place of sort of, it's got a lot of heritage in the region, you know, like from the Abyssinian Empire and whatnot. So coming back to today's politics and my history and how it all goes together is what happened was it was a British protectorate and then it was given independence in 1960. On the 26th of June, that was Somaliland, the northern region. And then the northerners went down south on the 1st of July, 4 days later, and demanded independence from the Italians so the whole region would connect as one, be called the the Federation of Somalia. Yeah. So that worked from 1960s up to 1991. So since 1991, the southern region of Somalia is classed as a failed state, and the northern region of Somaliland is technically not recognized by the British government or any other government in the world. but it is not a failed state. The northern region survives. I've been there many a times. It's the most amazing place in the world. And I'd like to invite any Bristolian to come along at any time.
Well, you look at the Foreign Office advice, it probably says don't go anywhere near this place.
The only reason why it says that, though, is because you can't really get the health insurance and whatnot, you know, so companies around the world won't insure you. But I know, as a British individual, it's a safe place to be. Do you know what I mean? We have, so the people that live there, they've got sort of British mentality and British sort of like their culture still within them. For example, I would drink, I'm more likely to drink, the northerners, I'm more likely to drink tea than they are to drink coffee. Things like that. Stuff like eat rice rather than eat pasta. So the rice is coming from the British Empire. It's coming in from the Indian Ocean, et cetera, et cetera. So the culture's still there. Even, for example, one word in my language, the Somali language, that the youth guys should use as well. For example, in English, a cupboard is a cupboard. Are you pointing out where your clothes are? It's in the cupboard. Do you know what I mean? So that's how far back our heritage together goes, you know? So, yeah.
Amazing. What about the English? Is it spoken much?
It is spoken there. Yeah, yeah, yeah. A lot of people understand English and they strive to understand English and they wish they had my accent. But, yeah.
But anyway, so you ended up as well, didn't you, now, you know, down on your luck, basically, with housing in this country. So how did that happen?
So it's been a bit of a rollercoaster ride in my life, really. So the way I see it is, I've grown up with mental health issues, unfortunately, and some of this was caused by being raised by adults that went through traumatic experiences in war and seeing murder and rapes and all sorts. And, you know, so these people that were raising me, my family, unfortunately, they were traumatized. So that trauma has then sort of fallen onto me as well.
Did they bring any kind of religious upbringing with them
Yeah, they did. Yeah. So they brought the religious upbringing, but it was more of the cultural upbringing as well that the sort of can be damaging at times, sort of that aggressive African tone and sort of, you know, sometimes the discipline. But it's, you know, for me, so it's, I've always tried to, I don't know, I've become a hybrid the way I see it now in terms of my personality. So, and I've learned to control my mental health issues. But yeah, coming back to the point of being homeless, it's been a steady decline in my mental health, really, that's got me there, along with a breakdown of relationships, a few crises as well, some social injustices. So it started off 2017 on the 1st of July. Come off my bike, had a little bit of an injury. A couple of weeks later, I'm feeling fine. On the 1st of August, I get hit by a car. Yeah, ambulance didn't turn up. The police don't bother turning up. The man's a drink driver. Yeah.
So was that here in Bristol?
That's here in Bristol, yeah. Lawrence Hill. So this is me becoming homeless. From 2017, there was a number of things that happened and occurred in my life that sort of drove to this homelessness. So one of the major factors was being injured and not being able to go back to work as quickly as possible.
I think, you know, for a lot of people who pass homeless people in the street, they think, well, thank God, I could never end up like that. Well, I think you better think twice, folks, if you're thinking that, because things can happen.
Things can happen. It can happen to anyone, especially, and with me, I fought it. I did my best. Even when I was homeless, I had three jobs. I was sleeping in a shelter on a church floor, Quakers Church in St. Jude's. That's where I was sleeping. And I had three jobs on the go. I was doing Deliveroo. I was working at Royal Mail. And I was also working at Bristol Water. Do you know what I mean? So I was doing my best. And then that's when I had a breakdown.
Was that because you were working too hard?
I was working too hard. I was too stressed. And I didn't have a secure home.
I mean, surely with those three jobs, you must have had enough of an income to be reasonably stable.
You had the income coming in, but you're still paying off the bills from previously because what's happened was, sorry, I haven't finished the story. So when I got hit by a car, I was married at this time. So there's a divorce that's occurred as well, unfortunately, and a breakdown in a relationship. So I was married, lived in together in a private apartment in the Barton Hill area. What happened was, there was a number of things that happened, unfortunately. And anyway, I ended up becoming homeless. And I was trying to pay off the debts at the same time. So it's that along with the divorce in itself. So the divorce in itself and then the culture of the divorce. It's not easy, you know, so it had me questioning my identity as to who I was.
Well, also, you've got a lot of outgoings, even with three jobs.
Definitely, yeah.
What were those jobs reasonably stable? Each one gave you a stable income?
Not at all, no. I'm not going to lie and say they were stable incomes. And then that's why it is when you say you had enough income coming in to sort of rent an apartment and whatnot, that wasn't the case because it's that input work poverty that people talk about. So I was working a zero-hour contract at Royal Mail Yeah. So they would call me in whenever they want. So do 4 hours here, do it 7 hours there. And then with the Deliveroo, there's only so many miles you can do that your body will allow you in terms of cycling through the rain, the cold and everything else that's going on, you know. And at the same time, like the main reason I was keeping myself busy working was I just didn't want to think about the fact that I was homeless, you know. I was homeless, but I wasn't hopeless, and I'm still not hopeless.
Okay, so did you manage to get out of that? Are you still homeless now? Are you in a different place or what?
So what's happened now is, unfortunately, I did have a breakdown in November of 2018. So, and then the doctor signed me off sick, and then that's when the local authority began the process of helping me out, sort of thing. And prior to that, they were sort of sending me to places, telling me, go stay here, go stay there. But that's when they recognised that there was an issue with the individual. And now I'm in a hostel, thankfully. But prior to being in the hostel, I have been through the pathway, as they like to call it, the homelessness pathway. And my God, I've seen a lot there.
I mean, let's just look for a minute at some of the statistics to do with homelessness in Bristol. I mean, we've got a Labour mayor, a Labour administration, who one would have hoped would be doing a lot for the poorer end of society. But actually what's happened is totally the opposite. Between 2015 and 2019, there's been an enormous rise in homelessness. So Bristol's homelessness is twice the national rate of people dying on the streets. The homeless hostels have been press reports about them simply failing to report deaths in those hostels. So that means that, of course, that the statistics could be inaccurate, but these hostels have to report when somebody who's one of their residents dies, but some of them have just simply been failing to do that. So in other words, that is kind of covering for the council and for the people financing the homeless hostels, as if there's, you know, no problem, when of course there is a problem of people dying in these hostels. We've seen a tripling of the number of homeless people dying in Bristol in the last 5 years, between 2014 and 2019. That was reported by ITV earlier this year, based on national statistics from the government. Just in the last year, between 2018 and 2019, deaths of homeless people in the city's gone up 20% in 1 year. So that's up by a fifth in a year. So it's going up at quite an incredible rate. The highest rate outside London of deaths of homeless people. Do you want to guess what the average rate of some year, how long people last before they die on average if they're homeless in Bristol? How old are you, can I ask?
Well, I'm 32.
32. Yeah, well, do you know what the average age of someone dying in homelessness is?
Roughly around my age, isn't it?
Well, actually, it's a bit older. 44 years old. Well, of course, this is half, pretty much half, the national average death age. Anyway, so there's some pretty horrific statistics there. Probably the most shocking is this enormous increase in just in the last 5 years, tripling the number of people dying who are homeless. But anyway, you know, you're in a hostel. Give us an idea of what it's like. Who's you around you? What's your day like?
So this hostel life, these statistics that you're stating, I completely understand them, and I've actually visualized these and I've seen them, I've witnessed them. So for example, along this pathway, this homelessness pathway that I've been in, at one point I was in shared accommodation in Easton, and it was right next to the train tracks.
So the idea here is it's a house owned by some sort of housing association or something.
The housing association, Housing Association would own the property.
Funded by the local authority.
Funded by the local authority.
And is it shared house, is it?
It's a shared accommodation. So let's say a four-bedroom, two up, two down, and then each room is classed as a sort of a license agreement per person.
Okay.
Yeah? So there's no tenancies, there's license agreements.
So you have like a shared kitchen, do you?
You share your kitchen and your bathroom.
How about you have a set? Oh, and any shared living room or any space?
Don't even
like
have a living room, no. But luckily for us, the rooms were big enough.
Okay, so shared kitchen, shared bathroom, the rest of it is individual units.
Which caused a lot of trouble, because even until today, there are lodgers living within the property that I used to live in. So what used to happen was, for the property that you'd have meant to be for four people in one room, there would be six up to eight people sometimes.
What?
Living there.
How?
They're homeless.
Oh, right. So this is somebody who is homeless.
Somebody
is saying, well, you can come and sleep in my flat.
Somebody that's come off the homeless pathway, that's been on the floor in that shelter or somewhere else or on the streets, yeah, that the council have now put in this place, feel sorry for their friends, and it's not the individual's fault. although it caused me a lot of pain and drama at the time because there was some Islamophobia, there was a lot that happened. But so, yeah, so you'd have that many people living in the, under one roof in one sort of, and then it gets troublesome with paying the bills, you know, because you have to pay the electric and the gas. And then you think to yourself, you've got six people. Do you know what I mean? In one room. Do you know what I mean? They're, are they paying their budget towards the electricity and the amount of the electricity they're using and the amount of hot water they're using? Mate, I used to have to queue for the toilet. But the point, coming back to the statistics and the deaths and whatnot, it's a tragic story, really. Tragic story that local authority do not understand and identify people that have bad health issues immediately, whether it's an invisible disability like mine, unfortunately, or whether it's a physical one that is visible, you know, because in this property that I used to live in, there was a man that had bowel cancer. And I won't mention his name because I don't want to breach anybody's data. Some of your listeners might know who I'm discussing, who I'm talking about, but please, let's not mention the individual. So this individual, I moved into this sharing property in January of 2019 this year, yeah, 2 days after my birthday, yeah. So when I moved in, this house was absolutely freezing, yeah? So there were leaks on the radiators, which meant that the heating wasn't working. So this individual has been living in this property for almost 2 years now, suffering with bowel cancer. He's got no central heating. The toilet was leaking into the sink. So imagine using your toilet, yeah? And it's leaking into the sink where you'd be preparing your meals, yeah? Where you're washing your dishes, sorry.
How can that be possible? A toilet is below the sink level, surely.
No, sorry, this is the kitchen. So the property is in such disarray. So I failed to mention as well, yeah. The property was right next to the train station.
Well, they call it self-help housing, this association.
Yeah.
So I guess they're saying, well, if you want to fix it, you've got to help yourself, fix it yourself.
The property, in fact, my friend who's from Holland actually looked at the property and he's an engineer, a structural engineer. He told me it's not structurally sound.
Structure of the building, as well as the things like the plumbing.
There was a lot going on in this property and it took me, I almost lost my mind as to how much I complained and like I've lost my rag at them, absolutely everything. And only when I was about to move out did they start taking care of these issues. And I said to them, I'm going to go to the papers, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. I ended up getting myself into a bad situation. Like I was saying, coming back to those statistics, those deaths, it's those people that I've seen on the streets, you know, the same people that were at the Goose. You know where the Goose is? Yeah, the people there. You see them disappearing one by one,
The free food cafe, yeah.
This is the free food cafe, basically. Mm-hmm. So when they do cut your benefits off and you've got absolutely nothing to eat, some people are there for addiction reasons. You know, some people, they do get their benefits, but they use it all up during the week and whatnot with drugs, unfortunately.
So where are you now?
So I'm at a hostel now. I'm staying in a hostel.
Because obviously you're trying to keep away from alcohol and drugs.
I've got an addictive personality and I'm trying to stay away from the drugs and absolutely everything. But I've grown up in BS5 and it's always been there, but it's whether you can keep yourself busy or not. And being stuck in a hostel where when you wake up every morning and you wake up to the smell of crack and heroin. I'll be honest with you. You wake up to the smell of crack and heroin.
So are they smoking heroin? Is that what's going on?
Obviously, that is going on in there, yes, 100%. Because what's happening is there's a group of individuals, unfortunately, who have hardcore addictions. They're in this hostel and they're slowly killing them off because they're just waiting for them to die, to take enough gear to die. Do you know what I mean? So on to the next one. Let's get them in there. On to the next one.
So is this simply because people don't want to come off these drugs or is it because there's not the facilities available, do you think? What do you think?
The money is there already, yeah? The will of the people that's working behind these charities and these organisations is there. But are we communicating and connecting these people together? No. Why? Because some people don't want us to get them connected because if we do help those people, they're going to need a house as well. Do you know what I mean? They're going to need a place in society. Do you know what I mean? And there are those out there that think that not everybody deserves a place in society, unfortunately, and that's what's going on.
So what's your situation with these people around you? Are you able to just shrug it off and say, right, I want nothing to do with that, because there must be a bit of a temptation to fall in with that. It's because, you know, if you're not having a particularly good time, you know, if, say, for example, you know, you saying you've your own mental health issues, if you're having a bad day, the temptation might be to hit the alcohol, and then it could be something else, especially if it's freely available.
Absolutely.
Well, not necessarily for free.
It's not freely available, no, but I think it's a case of, I've seen these drugs and what they do. I've seen them since I was a kid, growing up in Cardiff and Bristol. I've seen these drugs and what they do.
So can you go through some of the what you think are the worst drugs, the most dangerous?
So I'm talking heroin, I'm talking crack, I'm talking alcohol abuse when you abuse it, yeah? Whether it's cannabis as well, when it's abused, the stuff that's on the streets today is way too strong. The government need to legalize it and control it, because the amount of THC that's available on the streets is what's causing a lot of mental health issues.
So I can remember years ago, it used to be Jamaican weed, and you'd sometimes get hash as well. That was, you know, when I was a teenager. Mm. Nowadays, it's this skunk stuff, which
is
very, very powerful.
It's American. The idea of this skunk that we have at the moment comes from America, and the high quantities of THC, it's an American culture that's come over here, and it's really not good for our country. It really needs to be controlled, and that's what's going into the knife crime of London and in Bristol and all these other cities. It's this smoking of this ganja that's making them so paranoid, where they're not able to have a fist fight. They are so scared that they will go and get a knife. Do you know what I mean? It's a matter of fear. Do you know what I mean? And anxiety.
So when we're looking at the income for the people living in a hostel, I guess quite a lot of that is going straight to drugs, is it?
Unfortunately so, yeah. And I think it's...
The benefit system.
It's a benefit system. It needs a lot of control. It needs a lot more control, and it needs re-evaluating, and it needs management.
But these people need money to live, just like everyone else.
They need money to live, that's fine. But we should invest in more support workers. You know, support workers to help them. For example, the people that are at the hostel, some of these people, I wouldn't give them cash. I wouldn't give them cash at all, because I know what they're going to do with it. One of them's told me he's been an addict since he was 6 years old, you know? So I know exactly what they're going to do with it.
So what happens, you know, when they get their benefit cash through, whether check through or whatever, when they go to the post office and collect it?
They don't go to no post office anymore. It's all cash machines now. They look at the time. Is it midnight? Has it dropped? Yes, it has. I'm going out there making that call right now, taking all that money out, as much of it as I can take it out, and giving it straight to a drug dealer. That's what's going on. That's where British taxpayer money is going. It's going straight to the drug dealer. Do you know what I mean? That's where it's going, and this needs to stop. And that's why I'm saying we need a new police force in Bristol as well. We need a metropolitan police that understands the city, that understands its issues, and can. We need officers that are from the city. So I mean,
well,
from
we
the
also,
areas,
I mean, we did have, you know, a bit of an issue, didn't we? The beginning or in the middle of 2019 with the bear pit, particularly because there was quite open. Spice dealing going on down there. The spice dealers were
that's
down
one of
there.
The worst. That's one of the worst drugs.
Tell us about spice, because people think of that as an African drug.
Nope, absolutely. Spice is one of the most dangerous drugs you could ever have. I unfortunately had two puffs on it before by accident. Two puffs. I thought it was a spliff of ganja. Yes, I smoke weed. I don't promote it, but I do smoke it, unfortunately, yes. But yeah, so I had two puffs of it. I started hallucinating, and one of my friends looked like a fox to me. The other one looked like a hippopotamus. Like, you know Mr. Fox's advert? Have you seen Mr. Fox's advert, yeah? Literally, it's like looking at Mr. Fox. I was screaming my head off. It was the scariest thing that I've ever been through, and that's two puffs. Now, you see some of these people, they've got their head in their laps. Do you know what I mean? You don't know what's going on in their heads. So you don't know what's going to come up the aftermath
of
that.
Why is it that this dealing, for example, at the bear pit, which was going on literally a stone's throw away from New Bridewell Police Station, why are the police not act?
Because they know that there's an issue across society, this addiction. That this addiction issue that we have that's not been tackled over decades and centuries and not understood and not taught to kids in school when it should be, because I started smoking cigarettes in school. Do you know what I mean? So people should know about addiction. Do you know what I mean? So it's not fair on the police to have to tackle absolutely every societal problem, you know? The police have their role, and they must be assisted in that role. Education is one of the major roles that they need assisting in, you know? So if a lot more people educated about what they were taking, see what I mean? They wouldn't take it, which in turn, obviously the NHS as well.
Well, I mean, the thing is,
causes health issues and that.
Drugs have become quite a massive industry, organised crime, and that's not the easiest thing to take on.
organized crime is not the easiest thing to take on. That's true. But we have to come together as a society. We have to come together as a society, because what are we fighting for? We're fighting for not just ourselves, but for our kids and our kids' kids, for the heritage of mankind. Yeah. Are we going to let those that want to destroy some of mankind win? Or are we going to allow those that want to see every human being prosper win? That's the choice that we need to make, really. Do you know what I mean?
You also mentioned that you had your bike stolen the other day as well. Yeah. And I like this idea of, you know, the police need to up their game. Because I think, particularly around Stokes Croft area where mm-hmm. we are now, mm-hmm. you know, we don't see police at all.
That's what I'm saying.
They don't actually put themselves... I mean, I've been reading books from the 1920s mm-hmm. and 30s recently, and they're always talking about, oh, there's a... policemen stood on every corner. So it's the Met in London, but there's the guys stood there all night just on the corner looking for to make sure everything's all right. We get none of that at all now.
What do you think, 10 minutes?
You know, if you had the ear of the chief constable, what would you be telling him?
I'd be telling him that we need a new police force, even in Somerset. It's not good enough or big enough anymore, unfortunately. And that criticism is due to my experience. It's not from somebody else's experience. I've had numerous of encounters, and I'm not saying all of the police officers are bad, but there's a lot of rotten apples amongst Avon and Somerset police.
In what way do you think?
In the sense where there's a lot of institutional racism, and we have to talk about it. We really have to talk about it. We can't hide behind it anymore. Do you know what I mean? When I get hit by a drunk driver who's Caucasian, and then the police refuse to turn up, and then I told them that I have witnesses, and I gave them two Somali men as witnesses, and they've not accepted these as witnesses and told me later on that I had no witnesses, there's something dodgy going on there. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot going on. And in fact, what I did was afterwards, I made a complaint about this situation to what was formerly known as the IPCC. But at the time, they were changing over to the IPOC.
Yes, they've changed a few times, as I can remember their names. Mm-hmm. Still not really doing their job properly.
We don't need them
anymore.
Who
polices the police? This is always a question.
That's an issue, basically, because what's happened now is they said to me to go back to the police, even in Somerset. So I went back to professional standards. Professional standards were then investigating this for 10 months. I was followed by the police. I was followed around for 10 months, and it drove me nuts. I was sleeping in the park. I was homeless. I was on my way to work. I was doing this. I was doing that. And I was being followed by the police.
Sounds incredible. Anyway, how do we fix this? Okay, we've talked about the police, mm-hmm. but what about the wider picture with the city council mm-hmm. and homelessness?
So with regards to homelessness, I think it's a case where we, the people, have to take it upon ourselves to understand that we might not get help that we need from central government. So as a local authority and a local government, we need more power. You know, we need more power. And then as individuals that live within that local authority, we need to ask for accountability and responsibility from the local authority, you know?
So this is the mayor, the Paul Smith, who's mm-hmm. in charge of housing at the mm-hmm. city council. Mm-hmm. They say they're doing all they can. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I think the thing is also that there's quite a lot of derelict land out in the city centre. Mm-hmm. Certainly around St Paul's, there's mm-hmm. a lot of gentrification going on. Places being demolished, left for maybe 6 months, a year. Mm-hmm. That's space where potentially people could be living. They could be sites, they could be traveller vehicles, there could be caravans, there could be temporary toilets put in, the council could be removing the bins. But, I mean, I guess their attitude, Abs, their attitude is, well, if these people aren't paying council tax, they don't deserve the services.
We have to strive to make sure that everybody pays council tax. So we have to help people to get back into the position to pay council tax, because as human beings, we are one of the most beneficial things to this nation. Do you know what I mean? And the fact that we pay taxes as individuals, yeah, is what keeps us richer and keeps us going.
So the problem is that we've got a lot of the people who are poor, mm-hmm. okay, so people who are in debt, mm-hmm. etc., mm-hmm. like yourself, like mm-hmm. you were, mm-hmm. And those who are living on the margins of society simply can't afford to pay council mm-hmm. tax. There is this thing called council tax relief. Mm-hmm. But the people that can afford to pay it are mm-hmm. those with property.
Yeah.
In other words, so for example, self-help mm-hmm. housing.
Yeah.
They've got some money. They can pay what we used to call the rates, and it was back in the 1980s here in the UK under Thatcher that they got rid of this idea. They said, well, the people who own the property shouldn't be paying the rates. What we'll do is we'll change it so the people who are in that property have to pay it instead. And, of course, many of those people who are in that property just don't have money. So we've got a transfer of that tax from the people with the resources, that is to say the houses, the landlords, whatever, to those without the resources.
But I feel it's, we have to work on both sides. So it is a case, yes, where they need to take their responsibility more and maybe it should be moved over to them for a short period of time. But the individuals within these properties have to be able to grow and be given the opportunities to elevate themselves so they can pay to council tax, so they can go forward in life. It ain't just a case where they just want to be stuck there. A lot of people think that, yeah, I want to remain on benefits, etc., etc. No, absolutely not. Absolutely 100% not. If I had it my way, I'd be Prime Minister of the UK. Do you know what I mean? But obviously, I know what stops me at the moment.
In Britain, it has to be said, okay, we had a survey. Mm. I'm not sure who did it, so I can't remember, but it was looking at young people and saying that the young people in Britain are some of the most depressed in Europe.
We are. I'm not going to lie. Why wouldn't we be? Because the opportunities are not there anymore. Do you know what I mean? Like, we feel like the opportunities are not there anymore. And even when the opportunities are there, we don't have the basic fundamentals that used to help us get there before. Do you get it? So, for example, the kids that live in Easton and St. Paul's and everywhere else across Bristol that want to go to university have to pay £9,000. That's crazy.
For a lot of people, I think, they're going to university because they're worried that they just can't get a job elsewhere.
This
is a way. And, of course, they end up after 3 years with a degree that might be worth something. It might not. They might have learnt, you know.
But they haven't learned the skills, though. And I think it's another thing. We have to start from the bottom in terms of education and revamp the whole system. As I was listening to them guys, what are they called? Madhouse, Baggy Trousers, them guys, yeah. And they were saying, it's like, what did they learn at school? What did they learn at school? What did we actually
Madness,
learn at school?
Yeah.
Madness. What are we learning in our schools? You know what I mean? And we're not learning those life skills and that allow us to grow into the individuals that want to be paying as much money as we can in terms of taxes so we can help the poor.
Well, we are not learning critical thinking.
That's it.
This is one of the problems. I mean, certainly when we were being educated back in the 70s, there was a lot of that. Now most of it seems to have gone. Anyway, do you think your own prospects?
My own prospects? I'm thinking about moving out of Bristol. I'm thinking to myself, because I've been stuck in this homelessness pathway now for way too long, and I'm not going to get the help that I need.
Do you see prospects for getting jobs?
I thank God have a skill as a salesman. I can sell the back off anything. So I can sell, and I've also got communication skills, and that's always granted me enough to keep me alive and keep me off benefits. So I'm always going to be able to survive. But yeah. So
why not Bristol, though? Because, I mean, you know, surely you can get a job in sales, for goodness sake, round here.
I've had many jobs in sales. I've had fantastic jobs, and I love my city. This is my city. But right now, I'm stuck in a place where, like I said, when I wake up and I open my door to try to go to the bathroom, I smell heroin and crack. Do you know? That ain't right.
But are you not thinking, you know, what you're thinking is you're actually doing a geographical here, saying if I get another place, another physical space, everything will be better. But actually, you know, maybe all you need to do is just move down the road and, you know, move houses. Could you afford to do that?
It's unaffordable. That's the problem. It's absolutely unaffordable to sort of live in the Bristol area. What they're trying to tell me at the moment is like £650 to £700 for a one-bedroom flat. That's what I'm talking about. It's not affordable. So part of me is thinking to go live with family members in different cities across the UK, because we can't continue like this, you know? And then maybe I can start saving some money. When you live with someone, you start saving some money, build yourself up, you know?
That's the main problem, isn't it? That most people are like two paychecks away from being on the streets like you
were. That's it, literally. So it's a case of like, the motivation's always there to get yourself up and go do something. But do you know what I mean? It's more, what do they call it? The glass ceiling? So, like, the glass ceiling has gone higher and higher in the last 10 years as the Conservative government come in. It's gone higher and higher and higher, you know?
I mean, we're having to pay more and more money just literally...
For worse life.
To stand still.
Literally, to stand still, to not have
just
any
Just to have the basics, that is, to make sure you've got a tap which has got some water in.
That's it.
To make sure you've
got... Which is full of fluoride.
A few sandwiches, a few sandwiches to eat.
Yeah.
To make sure you've got a bed and a roof over your head.
Mm.
This is becoming ridiculously expensive.
It is.
I just wonder if at some point it's going to get back to some realistic level where you're actually paying for what you get. I mean, at the moment, it's quite obvious. People are paying far, far more if they're paying rent or paying a mortgage.
Yeah.
Than they should be. It's become a racket.
Yeah, it has become a racket. It's a mafia cartel thing in me, Bob Godon. It's just like the drugs across in South America. So that's a market, right? Yeah, and that's a $1 billion market, right? So is the housing market in the UK. It's worth, I think, maybe trillion or two. No, maybe more. So if we look back to the collapse of the economy back in 2008, 2009, yeah, all those people that lost those houses that the banks took over, we then bailed out the banks, and now the banks belong to us. But do we feel any richer for that? There we go. Those houses belong to us again, don't they not?
Thinking about your own situation now, Abs, is there any prospect of getting the hard drugs out of the hostel where you are?
Basically, when it comes to the police force, I don't trust them anymore. So it's like, at one point, I actually told the police to come in and investigate the owners and the employees of the hostel, because they're psychologically abusing us. How are you going to allow these people to continually take drugs and keep going on in this cycle, and you guys get paid for it? Do you know what I mean? I asked CID to investigate, but
well,
they haven't.
The thing is, of course, that there's quite a lot of people who are out there on the streets mm-hmm. that are like you. Mm-hmm. They don't want to go back into that hostile environment where yeah. there's hard drugs all the time.
That's it. They want to get away from
you,
it. Yeah.
You have got the wherewithal to say, I'm not going to take that stuff. Mm-hmm. They might not have.
That's it. That's it. And I think it comes to religion with that, do you know what I mean? Because I do my best to stick to my beliefs. And I know how lost I would get if I'd go on the pipe, the magic dragon, as they like to call it, you know. I'd sink deep down. But those that are out there, I'd say stay strong. I'd say do your best to stay strong, you know. Although you're homeless, we understand you're homeless, but you're not hopeless. No way ever you're hopeless. You are God's greatest creation, just like I am, yeah? And you're the best thing that exists in the world. Do not take your life, I'd say, because there's too many deaths. There's too many suicides as well. Do not take your lives. You're beautiful. Do not take your lives.
Solutions. Come on, Abs. Let's have
solutions. So with regards to the housing market and also a housing crisis, they like to call it. For 10 years, they've been calling it a crisis. It's a crisis because they haven't begun to deal with it. And in terms of a solution, we have to understand brick by brick as to where these costs, the astronomical costs, are coming from to build a house. Yeah? So if we can go make some bricks and mortar, yeah, and we know the full cost of that, yeah, where are all these extra costs coming in, where it's going to cost you a lifetime of money to buy a house? So why does it cost 150 grand to buy a house in the UK?
Why?
Yeah, why does it cost so much?
It's actually more.
It's even more, right?
Yes. So a quarter of a million average around here, I think.
Well, why is that, though?
Well, it's because it's a scarce resource.
Why is it a scarce resource?
Because, largely because of immigration. We've mm-hmm. had a massive influx of people into Britain, mm-hmm. and so the demand for housing's gone up, but yeah. the amount of houses being built haven't caught up.
It's not a case of catching up. They've stopped. The Conservative government over the last 10 years have not built a single property with public funds. Not a single property.
Well, they keep saying they've built more than everybody.
Than everybody else, but they haven't. Not with public funds. They haven't built a single property. It was on the Andrew Marr show. But so in terms of a solution, what we need to do is go back and find out and identify as to why it costs so much in the first place to buy the materials and the land and the process. We need to streamline everything. I think
you've got this thing going on at the moment where house building companies get permission, and it happened here at Finsall's Reach mm. in the city centre, the old brewery site, mm. Where they've got the permission to build loads of flats, luxury mm. flats, mm-hmm. but they don't actually build them. They wait until the few that they've built have sold, mm-hmm. and then they will complete the other ones. So this is a little nest egg which will chug along for several years.
Keeps getting higher and higher,
and maybe no builders will be there for 6 or 8 months, and suddenly the builders will turn up again and they'll complete a few more flats mm. because the ones that were completed last year have now been sold.
Definitely, yeah.
So there's a system, a kind of pipeline there for them, and there's no incentive for a company like that to be building houses. They wait until the ones that they've already built have been sold at the price they like.
Are they doing this for public money or their own funds?
Well, sometimes both.
Yeah.
Mostly this is with their own money. So mm-hmm. this is private house building.
Right.
This is one of the reasons I would suggest that we've seen nothing going on in St. Paul's. There's an enormous slice of land mm. near the old cardboard factory.
Yeah.
On, is it Dove Lane, I think?
Dove Lane, yeah.
And nothing happened there because this is just money in the bank. This land is money in the bank, and they would rather invest it in that than... They'll wait until it suits them, which may be 5 years, maybe 10 years, maybe so 20 years.
What can the lawmakers do in terms of regulation? And what,
well, they could tax that unused land, couldn't they? Yeah, that would immediately, yeah, they'd suddenly sit up and say, right, we better build some houses here then. You know, effectively, you know, government with the right kind of mind could requisition that land and say, right, well, you haven't used it, we're taking
it off. Why can't we do that as a local authority? So let's say, for example,
it's because they haven't got the cash to do it. I mean, it's millions and millions of pounds worth of land there. But they seem to have millions for things like Bristol Water and Bristol Energy, which that's seems to just go, the money's, go down the
money's
the drain.
Going somewhere else. The money's going somewhere else. And I think more accountability is needed. So in terms of a solution, more accountability is needed. In terms of a budget, I think we need a local budget that we all get to vote on. That's what I would say. As council taxpayers and as residents of the city, I reckon there should be a budget that we get to have a vote on as to how much should go.
Well, the
housing.
Idea is you get a vote and you vote in a mayor, and the mayor decides all these things because it's the mayor's decision.
It's not good enough anymore. It's not good enough. We have to take the power out of the hands of one individual. So this is what happened in Somalia. One individual had all the power, yeah? And then what does that do? It creates a, what can I say?
A dictatorship?
A dictatorship creates what? Different classes. So different classes and discrimination, that's how it works.
Well, it can create a tribal system where the person with the power basically just gets their mates and makes sure that they're sorted out and everyone else can take a running jump.
Yeah, yeah. Nepotism, yeah.
So any more solutions?
I think we need to look at building in the countryside and moving around as well. We need to move around a lot more in the UK. Like, one thing I was thinking about is potentially move to Scotland, you know? So, although that's not a local solution, it is a personal solution, it is. But as a local solution, I think it's a case of we have to look at giving power to local people to make decisions, you know, and that's what's missing.
You don't see that in Bristol, no?
You don't see that in Bristol, yeah. It's like what I want to see is I want to see people come up with policy ideas, having community meetings where we know, for example, in BS5, we're missing this, yeah? Let's have a meeting, put a policy together, put this in front of the local authority, et cetera, you know? And we're not, I don't know, what can I say? We're not involved in a democratic process as much as we should be.
Are you running for mayor then, Abs?
No, not yet. Not yet anyway. Not yet anyway. Got to get myself sorted out first. Then as soon as I am sorted out, though, I am dragging the rest of my people with me. All Bristolians, we're all going to the top. Yes, we're all going to the top. I say that because I want to live in a better city, you know. If I was a mayor of this city, it would be a much better city. That's what I know.
Well, what's the Bristol you'd like to see then?
The Bristol I'd like to see? No hardcore drugs. No hardcore drugs should not be available. I don't want to see people that are, for example, who are starving on the streets as well. That should not be happening at all. I want to be able to give that individual a place to go to where they can educate themselves and elevate themselves. And if they need help with their mental health or anything, they can just sort of get that support that they need, you know, because the monies and funds are there, but they're just being mismanaged.
I can remember the West Indian cameraman, Clive Smith, a piece he did on the BBC years ago, filming people and said, well, why are you here? He said, well, because it's the cheapest heroin in the country in Bristol.
That's it. It's too cheap. What is going on? It's like Bristol's been known for it for centuries, though, I guess, in terms of bringing stuff coming in from abroad and whatnot, you know, because we're a poor city, aren't we? So a lot of my friends have told me, yeah, mate, it's because we're a poor city. That's why we get the best ganja. That's why we get the most heroin, et cetera, but who knows these things? But I think, yeah, that's why we need a new police force as well. As I was saying, we need a new metropolitan Bristol police force, ones that understand this city, that grew up in the city, knows where this stuff is coming from, you know, that goes towards tackling crime, you know?
Do you think they're aligned with the gangsters, some of the police? I mean, this is always a suspicion, isn't it, that the police sometimes take two salaries, one from the public and one from the mob?
I would not be surprised. But I don't know. I can only speculate because I don't have any evidence, but I wouldn't be surprised because things have gone on for too long. The same individuals, the same people, same processes, yeah? Same police officers for how many years, all still on the same beat. See what I mean? Nothing's changing. That ain't right. I'll let you make your own conclusions on that, but that ain't right.
Well, Abs, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website, dialectradio, one word, www.abs.co.uk. Thanks to our guests Neil Clark and Abs Ali, also to studio engineer Dave Bazenko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday, midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Waliba asal dalad wanaga firka ulaha sarrainta ulaha sarrainta ada iman samanta waliba asal dalad wanaga ada iman samanta waliba asal dalad wanaga firka ulaha sarrainta ulaha sarrainta Adadadihiya ruhdo o daman onugyada chirkaygo o Adadadihiya ruhdo o daman onugyada chirkaygo o Ada ku alo sihiso darem ku astei labta Dunida iwa da iftiinshe Wahatta hay araksa nora asturan Daqani yuhishole Asaged ugu horreysa Amantana Amantana An idiku haysen Amantana Amantana An idinku haysan ahatono ahatay sidan rabnino ahatay rabina aqbalyo ahatay inaan qoys wada yaglelo marwada qura I ahato ahatono ahatay inaga way ino ahatay ahatono ahatay sidan rabnino ahatay rabina aqbalyo ahatay inaan qoys wada yaglelo marwada qura I ahato ahato no ahatay inaga way ino ahatay ahato no ahatay inaga way ino ahatay ahato no ahatay sidan rabnino ahatay rabina aqbalyo ahatay